This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to the best of Sounds Like Canada. You're listening to our podcast of the day's highlights of Sounds Like Canada, and you can catch our full show on CBC Radio 1 at 10 o'clock or a couple of times a day on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. In this half hour, another installment of a series, very periodic, called Sheila on Stage. And on Saturday morning, I had the great privilege of interviewing Elizabeth George, the American mystery writer. And yeah, just for the sake of it, I'll include her in our series of People I Want to Be Canadian. I was interviewing her for the Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival, and here's how it all went down. Elizabeth George fell in love with Britain while visiting as a teenager. She now divides her time between London and Seattle, England and Seattle. And over the course of 14 books featuring Scotland Yard Inspector Thomas Linley, she's probed British society and unraveled some fascinating cases. The Inspector Linley mysteries, as I'm sure you know, are set in contemporary England, and they've been turned into a TV series for Mystery on PBS, although their Linley doesn't look like your Linley, but he's okay. What Came Before He Shot Her is Elizabeth's most recent novel, and it's a departure. Instead of telling the story through the eyes of the police who solved the crime, it's the anatomy of a murder from the perspective of the 12-year-old boy who's thought to have committed it. It's also a searing portrait of a London family and a provocative look at class, race, and character. Please welcome, as you can only do in Vancouver, Elizabeth George. Okay. Elizabeth, you lived for many years in California, and you've recently moved to Seattle. Why didn't you move all the way to Vancouver?
It's so tough getting across the border these days.
Ah, I get it. But why the move to Seattle?
Well, I actually live now on Whidbey Island, although the year before moving onto Whidbey Island, my husband and I were in Seattle for that final year while our house was being built. And it came down to something very simple, and that is that I wanted to live in some place beautiful before I die. And Southern California, where I lived for 34 years, just didn't fill the bill for me.
I want to talk a bit more about what fills the bill for you as far as writing goes. But there's something that strikes me very much through your novels, and that is, actually, I can quote Inspector Linley, who says at one point, "I'd very much like someone to explain the human race for me." Mm. Is that what you're working out through your novels?
Yeah, I think it is to a great extent. There are so many complexities to the human condition that I find fascinating and that I want to explore in my novels. My novels have always been novels of character. Mm-hmm. They are, of course, crime novels, but the crime is merely an instrument. It's the vehicle that I use, what I call the through line. It carries the characters through the plot, but essentially what I'm doing is hanging on the structure of the crime and its investigation and its solution, an exploration of character, an exploration of theme, mm-hmm. looking at the dysfunctional family, looking at human psychopathology, because all of that is what really fascinates me.
One of the ways I think your characters are revealed to us is through their dialogue. And I think I could just read the dialogue without seeing said so-and-so to know. How much do you think dialogue reveals character?
I think it's crucial, because a lot of times I think what writers forget, especially neophyte writers, is that dialogue should be character-specific. Mm. And in a really good page of dialogue, or two or three pages of dialogue, you should be able to read it and know which character is speaking without the said, you know, with the, without the attribution. I can remember years ago reading a book by Toni Morrison, and when I got to this one, so I can't remember which one of her books it was, but I remember I got to this one extremely dramatic section where three people were having an argument, and she wrote the entire thing without attribution, and it was amazing because you could tell exactly who each character was, and that's the type of thing that I'm attempting to do with my own writing.
You were a neophyte writer once. What was your dialogue like then? What were your characters like then?
I think in my earliest days, I didn't do as much work on character as I do now. When I think of my days before being published, I was just sort of stumbling along trying to figure out what it was that would work, because I'm entirely self-taught. I took a couple of creative writing classes a long, long time ago when I was 19, but those were the kind of writing classes where, you know, you wrote a short story and everybody sat around and looked meditative about the story and you know, nodded and tried to give you criticism, except nobody knew really what they were criticizing because nobody knew what the fundamentals of writing were in the first place. So I basically taught myself how to write by trial and error. So early on, when I was doing characters, I think that I was relying just on real basic things to delineate character. I didn't really think about things like the telling detail of character from the exterior. You know, I call it landscape of person. Those elements of a person that you can pick out and that make them completely different from every other person. And then the telling interior details about them. Once I went to graduate school and got a degree in counseling and psychology, that gave me an enormous background in how to really explore people from their, you know, their core needs and their pathological maneuvers. But early on, I didn't know any of that. So when my first book was accepted for publication, I got a 9-page letter from my editor. And it was 9 pages, 22 paragraphs, filled with questions. Yeah. And the questions, I was responsible for answering somehow in revision, and she didn't tell me how to answer them. So when I was faced with that, and most of them were about character, when I was faced with that, I thought, there's got to be a better way to approach this. And that's when I began creating all my characters in advance of even writing the book, and then giving them all of these specific details and motivations that would then color their behavior throughout the novel.
I think with that kind of attention to character, you make us care very deeply about the characters as they continue through the series. And I think you know where I'm going with this. In the novel before what came before he shot her, you kill off one of our favorite, I think I can say that if you've read it, and I'm going to be very careful not to spoil it if you haven't read the novel before, but somebody dies that we care about. I almost phoned you. Why did you decide someone had to go?
Well, that decision I had made a number of years ago. I'd made the decision that I eliminated one of the five central characters. My books have five main characters and then myriad additional characters that are continuing, but there are five that are real central. And I had decided that I needed to eliminate one of these five characters, and I knew which character it was going to be. Now, the reason that I made that decision was that it's really important when anybody's writing a series in which the characters grow, change, and develop. And by that I mean it's not like the Agatha Christie series where Hercule Poirot is always Hercule Poirot. He never changes, and Miss Marple never changes. And that's a particular kind of novel, but that's not the kind I wanted to write, because I like to read novels where things change, where people change, where their circumstances change. In order to write that kind of novel, when it is a crime novel, which is different from when you're writing a novel like the Poldark series, which is, you know, set against the background of mining and Cornwall and all the stuff that went on there. Well, when you're doing it in the context of a crime novel, you need to always keep opening your story up with regard to the lives of your characters, and you don't want to do something to close the story down. Now, I always say to people, soap opera writers have always known this. because when in a soap opera, when the happy couple who throughout, you know, who have all these things go wrong and they finally get together, they get married, there's going to be a knock on the door a couple of days later, and it's going to be her ex-husband who had amnesia who's been wandering around town for, you know. And what that does is it opens up the story again. So essentially what I was doing is I was looking for a way artistically to keep my story opening up. So I knew that the best – you could do that two ways. You can eliminate a character through in a violent means that will then – that violent means will ricochet through the lives of all the other characters. Or you can bring on a new character. And I didn't want to bring on a new character because I had a whole bunch of people I was dealing with anyway. Mm-hmm. So I decided to eliminate a character. And then came the question of how to eliminate this character in a way that's thematically unified with the novel and has the most impact on the reader. Because to eliminate a character where at the end of it the reader just tosses the book over his or her shoulder and says, la-di-da, tomorrow is another day, what am I going to read next? That means the book's a failure. But to eliminate a character and to put the reader in the same position as all the other people are in who are experiencing the elimination of this character, that's what you want to attempt to do mm-hmm. as an artist. So when people were really upset with me and posting things on websites and writing letters and stuff, I didn't laugh at them, but I knew that that meant the book was a success.
Were you surprised at the intensity of that reaction?
I was surprised at people's anger. Yeah. That really surprised me a lot. And I guess I knew it was going to happen when I knew it would be effective because I have a cold reader, and then I brought in a second cold reader for the book. And my cold readers are people who read my books in the early drafts, and say they usually see the second draft. And both of them had the same reaction. They said that when they got to that part in the book, they had to set the book aside for several days before they could go back to it. So So when they reacted that way, I thought, okay, I knew the book worked.
Yeah.
But the surprise for me was people's anger, and I had to work through that in my own head to understand why people were angry. Mm-hmm. And then I recognized that part of it is that people were not expecting that to happen at all because they were expecting there was going to be sort of a deus ex machina or something, that last moment that eyes would pop open I'm saved.
But you know, I have amnesia.
That'd be good. I didn't think of that. But when that didn't happen, and then the combination of that not happening, but to have it occur in I think what was an extremely sensitive scene where the plug is pulled. I think it was, if I do say so myself, I think it was pretty sensitively written, and that I don't think it was maudlin. I think it struck just the right notes. And so
how do you know when something strikes just the right notes?
Well, I don't think you ever, you never really know.
But don't you get this physical sensation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was one part when I was writing it. Yeah, let me go back. I'll address that in a minute. But there was one part where I was actually writing it, and it was only one part. And it's the part where there's a mother who says to her son, whatever happens, I want you to know you are equal to this moment. And I just thought, whoa, what a thing to say. What a thing to say. It's like that is not what my mom would have said. She would have somehow made it my fault. You know what I mean? Really? She would, I'm telling you. And so for her to say this, for this woman to say this incredibly loving thing, it was the most loving and supportive thing. I mean, I cried when I wrote that. And so that tells me that, if the author's crying, then, chances are that it's going to have some sort of effect on the reader. But it's really tricky because I wanted that whole section of the book to be very restrained. So I chose some things that were poignant, but I thought held restraint. The way that the one man, puts his hand and won't take his hand off the other man's arm all the way to the hospital and stuff like that, I thought was, was that that's the kind of thing I mean. It's like a little detail. It's not over the top. There's no violin music being played. There's no you know, overuse of adverbs. It's just that gesture. And I think sometimes that the one small gesture is much more important than some big sweeping thing.
You said you'd address the physical sensation.
What was it?
Is it a buzz? Is it? Is it?
What I've learned over time is that writing is very visceral. It is not, although it seems like it's an intellectual activity, and the putting together of the story is indeed an intellectual activity. The actual writing of the story, sitting there at the computer, doing the rough draft, is extremely visceral. And that when I'm doing any section of the novel that requires me to try to get in touch with the right side of my brain, which is, you know, generally like most of the sections, but I trust my body to tell me when I'm doing the right thing. And my body never lies to me. And I always tell my writing students that your mind will lie to you all the time, but your body will never lie to you. So when you get that sick feeling about something you're writing, trust it. On the other hand, when you've got the committee up here saying, oh, no, you're really lousy, you're horrible, this is crap, on, don't trust the committee. Because the committee, that's everybody that you always knew in your life who, you know, the girls that didn't invite you to the birthday parties when, when you were young. You know, the nuns at the high school, all that's the whole, you know, the boys that never invited you out on dates. That's the committee, and they're going to always be telling you whatever you're doing is really bad. So I would ignore that, but I never, never ignore that sick feeling. It's like right here in the solar plexus.
I want to ask you about your latest novel, now out in paperback, What Came Before He Shot Her, because we don't have the regular cast of characters, diminished as it is by one. We have the story told from the point of view of the 12-year-old who was there and has been accused of actually pulling the trigger. Why did you decide to go back and investigate the anatomy of this murder and the events leading up to it?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. Initially, the story that became What Came Before He Shot Her was going to be part of the novel preceding this, a novel called With No One as Witness. And what I wanted to do was to create an hourglass structure within a large novel in which the reader would be reading the story of this boy, Joel, who's 12 years old and lives in northwest London, and then would be reading the investigation into a serial killer who's going around killing boys of a similar age. And I thought that what the reader would think was that here I am setting up this little boy to be one of the victims, only to discover that what I'm really doing is setting up the little boy to be a killer. And that the books would meet at this one moment, this terrible moment when this person is killed on the street by this little boy, and then they would go on their separate ways. But as I was beginning to create that story, I started to see that to do Joel, what I call Joel's story, that's the little boy, to do his story justice, I really needed its own novel. So that what I decided to do is to this then create a situation in which What Came Before He Shot Her then goes back in time. And now 18 months before the tumultuous death in with No One as Witness. And now we go back in time, but the reader wouldn't necessarily know, the reader just opening the book, wouldn't necessarily know that's what we're doing. All of a sudden, they would just be reading about this little 12-year-old boy, and there would be this moment in this book where they would go, oh, wait a minute, I think I know where we're going. So I wanted to do that, but I also wanted to, for the first time, write in what's called omniscient point of view. It's an outside narrator who's telling the story, and that I'd never done that before. And it's a lot of people think it's the easiest point of view to write in because you are you can get in everybody's head, but you can't. You can get in no one's head. So that was another reason why I created this book.
What Came Before He Shot Her opens with I'm not giving anything away here, the voice of a Jamaican grandmother in dialect. And so you are really going somewhere new, and you're dealing with the lives of a mixed race family who have every single obstacle put in front of them. What did this allow you to explore about race and class in North London?
One of the experiences that I had that I found so interesting when I was doing the research for this book was going to Holland Park School. Holland Park is, if you've been to London, or you may or may not know, is a very, very tony area of town. Magnificent mansions and these beautiful, beautiful red brick buildings. And just a really kind of an astonishing place. It's where P.D. James lives. In the middle of Holland Park is Holland Park School. And you would expect that Holland Park School would be of a similar kind of place and a similar kind of clientele, as it were. But it's not. Holland Park School is sort of like this inner city school that's set right here in this mm-hmm. incredible neighborhood. The kids that live in Holland Park don't go to this school because, of course, they would have to mix. They don't want to mix. So they all get, you know, trucked out by their parents to private schools, private day schools, boarding schools. And then in the school itself is the majority of, you know, black kids. And that would be the vast majority of the school, black. And then you have what they call Asian, so the Pakistani kids, mm-hmm. Indian kids, etc. Well, that kind of contrast that exists in London is amazing to me. I also wanted to look at the fact that these neighborhoods that I read a great deal about and indeed saw that are so dangerous at night are completely mm. innocuous during the daytime. Mm. And you could indeed, you know, buy a house in one of these areas and never know that you were getting, you know, buying into this big this big neighborhood with all kinds of gang violence going on, because it just doesn't look like that. And I found very interesting the fact that this one area where the book takes place had been through many, many changes and many different cultures had moved in and out. And that, too, I found really interesting.
I suppose that you've often looked at class. I mean, always looked at class through your stories, because you've got Havers and you've got Linley.
Right.
How did those two characters appear to you, first of all?
Well, first let me say that, you know, in writing about England, it's really hard not to look at class. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a lot of times my British editor once said to me, oh, come now, there's no class system in England anymore. And I said to him, that's because you went to private school and then to Cambridge. So, of course, there's no class system as far as you're concerned. But, you know, ride around on the underground with me and you'll see. And one time he did ride on the underground with me. I think it was probably the only time he ever did that. Mm-hmm. And he did see. But it's a... With Linley and Havers, it was they came about in a really simple way. First of all, with Linley, he wasn't my first main character. My main character was going to be the forensic scientist, St. James. I thought that would be interesting to write about a forensic scientist. And I did do two books where he was the central character and the one who was solving the crime. But neither of those books was published. So when I tried my third one, I thought, well, I've got this guy Linley. Oh, because I needed for St. James somebody who came to him with problems that needed to be resolved from Scotland Yard or elsewhere. So I thought, well, who is this guy? He needs to have somebody. And I decided that this guy would be Thomas Linley. And then I thought, well, I mean, it's really ridiculous. This shows you, because I never expected to get published. So I'm just writing for my own enjoyment. So I thought, Thomas Linley, well, who will he be? And then I thought, oh, this is so cool. I like the way the British can do this thing where they have two different names, like George Gordon, Lord Byron. Well, that was so cool. So I thought, well, I'll make this guy Thomas Linley, Lord Asherton. And then I thought, well, okay, now I've done that. What does he have to be a Lord Asherton? Well, I knew that Anthony Armstrong Jones was Lord Snowden, and he made that because he was the Earl of Snowden. So I thought, oh, okay, well, I'll make this guy the Earl of Asherton. And what happened is over time, then you have to start building. If he's the Earl of Asherton, what are the accoutrements of earldom that he might possess? You know, well, he has the whole family pile in the country. He has the house in London. What kind of car? You know, and I gave him a Bentley because I didn't know any other big cars. And it took me years to figure out how to wreck that car. And it's just like, I had 14 books. It took me, finally, So he drove around in a Bentley because I didn't want him to give him a Rolls Royce, and I didn't know a Bentley was a Rolls Royce with a B on the hood. So here he's in this huge car driving around. But so that's how, you know, so he just pretty soon there's, you're piling up all this stuff. And it was kind of like, why not write about somebody who's rich? Who wants to write about somebody that's poor? So I thought, you know, I'm not rich. I'll write about somebody who's rich, and he's got this great car, and he has these beautiful clothes, and his great townhouse, and all these things. And then when I was going to give him his own book, because the first two books with St. James as the main character didn't work, so I thought, well, let me give him a book. And I thought, well, he probably needs a partner then. So then it became, well, who's his partner? Well, I was smart enough, thank God, to recognize that Linley was pretty outrageous a character with all of this stuff that he was, baggage he was carrying around, including the fact that he was nice looking and he could quote Shakespeare and, you know, I mean, all this stuff. So I thought, you know, he probably is not going to be really believable or likable. So I need to prescribe the reader's symptom, which means invite the reader to dislike him. Mm-hmm. And so you need a character who dislikes him that you meet in advance to invite the reader into this disliking thing. And that became Barbara Havers. And she was just everything that he wasn't. So she's just his polar opposite. And then over time, she, you know, developed more and more attitude. Her attitude is really pretty similar to what my attitude is. And so I, you know, she gets to say the things that I sometimes only think. And she gets to do things that are, that I would, I wouldn't necessarily do some of the stuff she does, but she always makes me laugh.
She makes me laugh too, and I you know, I hate to see her described as dumpy. I really do.
But that's part of the fun.
Okay, bum glue. What is it?
Oh, it's you know, putting the pedal to the metal. It's that willingness to sit there and to do the work. And to, I call it actually, bum glue was an expression that Bryce Courtney, the writer from Australia, used to talk about your willingness to sit there. I call it suit up and show up. That's what I do every day, is that I suit up and show up at the computer. And I do that when I'm at home 5 days a week. When I'm on the road, I still do it. When I'm on vacation, I still do it. And it's that willingness to put in the work that gets the book done.
Okay, good. The other question I have, because you were able to kill off a character, you wouldn't retire Linley like Ian Rankin is with Rebus, would you, too soon?
I really didn't have any intentions of doing that. And that was another thing that really surprised me about letters that I got from people saying, if you wanted to end the series, why did you end it like this? And I'm kind of looking and going, why wouldn't anybody think I was ending the series? I certainly wouldn't have ended the series like that, and really had no intention of ending the series. But I don't have any plans to retire him at this time.
Or Havers.
Yeah, no.
Okay, good. All right. That's good. Okay. Thank you for this time.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Bum glue.
Elizabeth George is the author of What Came Before He Shot Her. It's published by HarperCollins. Her new novel in the Inspector Linley series comes out in May, and it will be called Careless in Red. I spoke with Elizabeth George at the Vancouver International Readers and Writers Festival. My thanks to them for their great hospitality. The next in our Sheila on Stage series will occur on November the 22nd in Vancouver at the Heritage Hall on Main Street. I'll be speaking with David Suzuki. More on that as we get closer to the date. That's the best of Sounds Like Canada. Highlights from our show on CBC Radio 1, heard weekday mornings at 10 o'clock. I'm Sheila Rogers. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.